History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated for sure. We're always entertained. And I hear from so many of you that just like I am, you're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I had the chance to witness a pretty unique moment with one member of that generation this week in Washington, D.C., and I was reminded of how the opportunity to honor veterans from that era has helped shine a bigger and just as deserving spotlight on the generations of veterans that have followed them. But before we get into that, my heart has also been heavy with news of the passing of some incredible World War II veterans that this audience has gotten to know a little over the years. 90th Infantry Division veteran Vern Schmidt's passing came as a stunner because he was so full of vigor and so enthused about upcoming opportunities to meet people like you, to sign more copies of the book about his life, and to help send more veterans to their memorials with Honor Flight. Betty Rosevere's passing at 104, more than 80 years after her Gold Star hero husband's ultimate sacrifice in World War II inspired her to serve as an Army nurse. We're going to talk more about those two in upcoming episodes, but before we get into a powerful moment in Washington, D.C., in which a pair of generals joined an enraptured crowd in listening to our last living link to a special element of history, let's remember a hero from the home front. While 16 million Americans put on uniforms in World War II, the war effort was far more extensive than that. A memorial service I had the privilege of attending this past week celebrated the life of Angie Schiappi, who passed away on Easter Sunday at the age of 101. She was one of approximately 6 million American women who became Rosie the Riveters, pumping out all those things the men overseas needed to fight the enemy.
We lived in Pittsburgh, California, and my mother had, at the time that I was about three, there was only five children. But my grandma lived with us, and my grandpa, and my aunt and uncle, because things were very poor then, and, you know, it took a lot of money to feed all those kids and all those people. And my mother was a sick lady. She had epilepsy. So my grandma took care of all of us. So as we grew up, I got real attached to my grandma. I went everywhere with her, everywhere. My father worked at the steel mill, wasn't making too much money. My mother made good meals, made them last a long time, no leftovers. And we were a happy family, because I didn't know any better, no different, you know.
And your parents had both immigrated from Mexico.
Yes.
So when you talk about your mother's cooking, I've got to hear what was the best, because we live here in the San Joaquin Valley. There's a lot of good Mexican food around here. What did she make?
She used to make homemade tortillas, rice, beans, enchiladas, tamales, you name it, everything. And I could do the same thing.
You do the Christmas tamales also?
Yes. About 100 tamales every Christmas.
Wow.
Yes.
What time should I show up?
About 7 o'clock. We start early in the morning. I make my mole the day before, but it's been a tradition. We make tamales. I follow my mother's tradition. Every year she made them, well, since we were little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you said back when you were 3 years old. I mean, that's in the 1920s.
And yeah.
Those early years for you are the years that America was in the Great Depression.
And very bad.
You were one of eight siblings.
Yes.
What do you remember about those years, and how did your family get by?
Well, like I say, my father and mother, my mother was ill, and my grandma lived with us. So they pulled their money together and did the cooking together. And we had a old house, big house, and the kids were all piled up, you know, sleeping together, and we were happy. My father worked shift, day shift, night shift, and trying to keep us quiet when Dewey's trying to sleep. So I remember a lot of that. My mother had epilepsy, and I remember when she fell over a couple of times when I was little. And of course, it scared me, but we got used to it. But we were a happy family.
And I always talk to people in your age group, and I'm always fascinated by how different life was back then. But especially for women, for young girls.
Mm-hmm.
The world was a very different place compared to 2020.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember having some ideas of, hey, when I grow up someday, I might do this or that?
Yeah, I wanted to be a nurse. I wanted to be a nurse to take care of sick people. Because my grandmother was a midwife, and I went everywhere with her. She delivered a lot of kids there, a lot of kids. I didn't know what was going on. I just saw her get some rubber gloves and let's go. And I'd go with her, and I didn't know what she was doing, you know, but she was delivering children. She delivered all of us. And she told me what to do, but I learned a lot from her. I was very attached to her.
And how about your siblings? You got 8 kids in the house, and you said you're all sleeping practically on top
of
each other.
Oh, yeah. Well, my sister, Allison, Connie, and me slept in one bed, and I used to say, don't touch me. Just a double bed with 3 people in it, you know, don't touch me. Of course, I'd start screaming, and I was very thin, very, very sickly, too. I was anemic, had a bleeding nose all the time. I was cross-eyed. I was sickly, and I hated school. I hated school.
Why is
that? I was in the sunshine class because it was a special class for skinny kids. And that was me. I was sickly.
So they called it the sunshine class because you guys needed vitamin D from the sun?
Yes,
something?
And cod liver oil every day.
I guess it worked.
I think it worked. It stayed in me.
We get into your teenage years. You're going to high school?
Yeah, up to the 11th grade only. I started working in the cannery. Friends of mine started quitting school and working, and they says, we're making 75 cents an hour. So I says, I want to try it. So I did. And my mother got mad because she wanted me to go to school, and the truant officer came looking for me. And I says, no, I'm going to work. So I quit school.
What kind of cannery was that?
Asparagus in Daniel, California. The bus would take us.
There's a day that unfolded in there somewhere. I guess it would have been right before your 17th birthday, a month before, December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that?
The war?
Yeah, Pearl Harbor.
Roosevelt was president, I know, and my father was very upset. But other than that, I don't remember too much more about that.
You know, I've heard over the years from people who lived in the Bay Area at that time that there were curfews, there were, you had to black out your windows because people thought the Japanese may come there.
Well, the thing is this, on July 17, 1944, my father and mother had come to Fresno to look for a house because we were going to move. And in Port Chicago, about 10 miles from Pittsburgh, there was a big blow up, a big ship blew up.
Yeah.
And we could see it from our yard.
Wow.
The sky all red. And I lived in an Italian neighborhood, and the ladies out there were screaming that the Japanese had bombed us.
Wow.
But it didn't happen. No, it's just something that just happened over there. So I remember that, July 17, 1944.
And back before that, with, you know, when Pearl Harbor happened, were your friends talking about this? Do you remember, you know, life changing where you lived at all after that?
Yeah, they started building a Camp Stoneman for soldiers there. It was a depot to go overseas. My father didn't like the idea of us living there with all those soldiers back and forth in the neighborhood. But they put a stop to them coming to the neighborhood. There was a lot of robberies and stuff. So he didn't like staying there. He didn't like living there. He wanted to come to Fresno.
When we talk about World War II, we talk about the soldiers. We talk about the sailors and the Marines and the airmen. But all the things that they were operating, the ships, the planes, the tanks, those really all had to be built. We didn't have those sitting around before the war started. And you and your family were very involved in building ships. Where, how did that start?
My father was working at the steel mill, and he had some friends who told him that they were hiring at the shipyards in Richmond, California, about 35, 40 miles away. And so he went and he got the job, quit the steel mill. And him and my brother went, and they started working there. And they told us that we should go and try to get a job there. So my sisters and I went with them. And we applied, and they said, yes, they want to be welders. They put us to welding school, and I didn't like it because I think it was too heavy. The hood, everything. I says, I don't like this one bit. So he says, okay, you can be a burner. It's easier. So that's how we started. That was in November of 1943, and we worked till July of 1944. All
right.
That time, building those ships. Getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Being there by 7 and working till 4 in the afternoon. They had 3 shifts going. A lot of people. There was hardly any men because they were all drafted.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of women and old people, old men, and all women mostly.
Would your whole family work the same shift?
No,
would
you? We'd all go. My father would drive us. He had a 1939 Mercury. And, you know, gas was rationed then. My father had to get stamps to put gas in the car. because we were working in the shipyards, he got extra stamps. That was hard. Meat was stamped too. Yeah, everything was rationed. He had to put the shades down. It was hard, very hard. And he would drive us in the morning. My mother would get up and make lunches for all of us. Or sometimes we'd buy the hot lunch there, half asleep, you know. And we didn't buy, wear no clothes. Levi's and sweatshirts and flannel shirts and boots. That was my wardrobe all the time.
Were you ever concerned that you couldn't do that job?
No. I like to be around people. I'd like to be out in the, with everybody, you know, learning. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't hard work at all. Just carry the settling with you and you hook it up and, you know, do what you have to do.
Well, yeah, and I want to understand this process. But first of all, what kind of ships were you guys building?
Liberty. Liberty ships. You're working three shifts very fast. Before you know it, was up. My father and brother were riggers. They would just tell the crane guy over here, you know, they wore helmets. So, yeah, my sisters were welders. They were spotters. They would put the seam together, and the horseshoe like this, and weld it. And then I would come and burn it out. That was my job. But it was fun. It was fun. We were making a lot of money.
Was that the Kaiser shipyards?
Kaiser, Richmond Kaiser. There was three shipyards, one, two, and three. We worked at number two.
Five of you were going every day.
Every day.
You think there was any family that had more?
Oh, yeah. A lot of our friends were going. Their families were all going. Same setup. They work in a different yard, but everybody was trying to make a buck.
Did you understand the significance of what you guys were doing?
Yes, I did. And we were doing something good, and we were making money. All of a sudden, we got money, you know, do what we want to do. That's why we came to Fresno, and we bought the house here, my father and mother.
With the money earned at the shipyard?
Yes. My father and mother were married in Fresno.
Okay.
1921 at St. John's Church.
Wow.
They lived in Del Rey. Uh-huh. So that they wanted to come back to Fresno because the soldiers were taking over the town over there. We decided to move to Fresno.
Did you have a lot of friends from school or family friends who were sent overseas, who were fighting in that war?
A lot of my class went. My sister's boyfriends went, and had cousins who went, and neighbors. They all got drafted. A lot of Italian boys went, because it was little Italy there, and we used to love to dance.
Yeah?
Oh, Glenn Miller. I got all his records. Yeah, they used to have street dances. Most of the neighbors knew how to dance. So that was a lot of fun.
So I'm trying to understand, you know, life at the shipyards. There's a ton of people there.
Mm-hmm.
You're working a long shift. You're working hard. How were you treated by everybody else there?
Very good. We had older guys who were our bosses. They treated us very nice. Don't lift that too much. Don't do this. Don't do that. You know, very nice. Because you're young, 18 years old. You know, you can lift anything.
And help me understand exactly what you did. You said you were carrying an acetylene torch around?
Yeah, carry it to the thing and then hook it up. And then when they needed any burning, I would take it over there and light it and do what I did. They called them horseshoes. And this was welding, and this was welding, holding this together. And I would have to take it out after the girls welded this.
All right.
So, yeah, and then I just toss it. They had a big bucket you toss it in. I had a boss that followed me around, helped me sometimes with the line. But it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Did you see people's attitudes toward women changing because of what you were doing, what all you ladies were doing?
Not really. I was just treated very nice. And then if you needed a rest to go to the bathroom, they had a policewoman in there saying you could only be here 10 minutes. They watched you.
They wanted you to be
working. Yeah. They want you out in the field again. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I've interviewed quite a few soldiers, veterans, who were Mexican-American or of Hispanic descent. Some of them said they had no problems in the armed forces with discrimination.
Yeah.
And others felt it very severely that they were discriminated against or treated differently because of their ethnicity.
No.
You never dealt with any of that there.
I could speak Spanish and everything. If you spoke Spanish, I spoke Spanish to you. I wasn't ashamed of my language. Not at all.
What did you enjoy the most about your time as a Rosie?
Just being with the other women. I all had stories. My husband's overseas. My father's overseas, you know. Some were just alone because their husbands were gone. They thought they were doing their bit, too. I don't remember any of those ladies when I went to that thing because everybody's changed. Some of them worked in the shipyards with us, but everybody's changed so much. You don't remember who it was, you know. But, you know, every time they launched a ship, it was a lot of fun.
What would they do?
Oh, a lot of dignitaries came. They get the champagne bottle, whatever they do. And that was a lot of fun to watch. And then they had the shows. The USO shows.
Yeah.
The Andrews sisters came. Bing Crosby came. You know, at our lunchtime, they had a little stage. We'd sit on the ground, and they perform. And that was a lot of fun for an hour.
Well, I guess that right there shows you the importance of what you were doing. Because that's the same treatment they gave the troops overseas, bringing Bing Crosby or Bob Hope.
When the other sisters came, my father loved it. He loved it. But then we saw Bing Crosby and Bob Hope came too. But I didn't care for him, you know. His jokes didn't do anything for me. We knew the war was going on, and we had to keep the shades down and, you know, do what they told us to do. You were living in the dark, really. He was tired of it. He didn't want to stay there no more.
You might have kept working at the shipyards if he didn't move you
here. We could have kept working, because all my friends were still working. Girlfriends that we had, you know, they were still working. And then we moved here, and I lost contact, you know.
So you would have been here when VE Day and VJ Day came around?
Oh, yeah. I was working at the Al drugstore for less money.
Can you help us understand how big a deal that was when that war that had been going on for so long was finally over?
Oh, everybody was cheering. Everybody was so happy. We had a lot of soldiers here and there. There was a couple of camps here, and they used to come in the Al drugstore. I used to work at the fountain. They came with the uniforms, and everybody was hugging them. We were all happy. It was over with.
And none of your brothers ever got drafted or anything?
Oh, yeah. My three brothers all went. My brother Ernie got drafted first, and my brother Junior went in the Navy, and my brother Jerry got drafted in the Army. My sister Alice, her boyfriend, he was in Italy, and my sister Connie's boyfriend was in Germany. And I had friends in Pittsburgh, a lot of friends that had gone in the service, and a lot of them had passed away.
For someone who didn't live it, how would you explain the significance or the importance of you and all the other Rosies in the bigger picture of World War II and what ended up happening?
I always think about, where are they at now? You know, I've been there. I did that. I wonder what happened to these people. We were so happy, so young, doing all this and all that. I never thought that I'd get this old to think about it and look back to see what I did. I'm glad I did it.
And why does it matter? What do you think you accomplished?
Because I put my 2 cents in. I did my thing. At least I did something.
And if you weren't all doing it, then it might not have had the same outcome.
No. Mm-mm. I think about all the Rosies that, you know, are gone. They did their bit.
It sounds like this is something that you're proud of.
Yes, I am. I'm proud of it, yeah. Looking back, I'm saying, how could I have done that? You know, how could I have done that, you know? I was wild, you know. 18 years old, you're raring to go.
And she had that same passion till her final breath at age 101. The late Angie Schiappi, whose older sister is the last Rosie the Riveter from her family, still going at 103. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, a moment that unfolded in Washington, D.C. this week that the people there for it will never forget. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where if you've ever listened to this program before, I'm pretty certain you've heard me talk about the Honor Flight Network, a nationwide effort that started 20 years ago when one man, Earl Morse, decided to fly veterans to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. Since then, it's expanded to celebrate veterans from the Korean War and the Vietnam War and the years in between. And when the currently under construction memorial for those who served in Desert Storm and Desert Shield are complete, those veterans may soon have the chance to experience the magic of Honor Flight II. We've met veterans from all across the country whose local areas have found a way to generate the financial support to get them there. And in Central California, where I live, we've been taking local veterans to Washington since 2013. But I've never seen a moment quite like what I witnessed this past Tuesday at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum's Stephen R. Udvar-Hazy Center. In front of the perfectly polished, reflective frame of the historic B-29 Enola Gay, the last man alive from that bomber's squadron and group held court for about 20 minutes. detailing his memories from more than 8 decades ago and keeping an audience that included schoolchildren, fellow veterans, and even a pair of highly decorated generals from the Air Force and the Space Force in rapt attention. You've heard Norris Jernigan on this program before, but to have this 100-year-old effortlessly detailed a monumental piece of history that he is our last living connection to was pretty surreal.
Well, in the spring of 1943, I was a high school student looking toward June when I would turn 18 years old. And the war was raging on two fronts, Europe and the Pacific. I knew I would be drafted because come June 11, I would turn 18 and would be required to register for the draft. Other friends that had registered didn't stick around very long until they were gone. I wanted to select my own branch of the service, not be put somewhere at somebody else's idea. So I talked to my dad, and he had agreed to sign for me. So the day before I was 18, I raised my right hand and was sworn into the Army Air Corps cadet program, thinking I was going to become a pilot. Well, I was in the program for 3 months, so I did get some benefit out of that, of being an aircraft student, and was enrolled in the Denver University and spent a semester in Denver University, and part of the curricula was 10 hours of flight instruction. So I did have 10 hours of flight instruction out of it and a semester at Denver University, which helped later when I did go to college. Prior to that, when the cadets would wash out of the program, they would be sent to a trade school for airplane mechanic, radio operator, radio repairman, whatever. And they had decided with this group that was being eliminated, they would just send them out to tactical units training for overseas duty. They thought they could just learn it as on-the-job trainees from the guys that already know the job, which would be essentially the same thing as if you went to one of the trade schools. I was sent to Fairmont, Nebraska, Fairmont Army Air Base in Nebraska, where I was there to be part of the activation of the 393rd Bomb Squadron. And there were three squadrons developed at the same time there, and we were all part of the 504th Bomb Group, and started our training in the spring of 1944. By the end of summer, the training was complete, and we were waiting for our overseas assignment when orders came through transferring the 393rd Bomb Squadron intact from Fairmont, Nebraska to Wendover, Utah. We had no idea why we would be taken away from the group. We were ready to go overseas with the group. It was not to happen. When we arrived in Wendover, we were told to assemble. Someone wanted to talk to us. And when we got together, this lieutenant colonel got up in front of us and said, "Gentlemen, you're probably wondering why you're brought here." Well, that was the right question. We had no idea. Anyhow, he said, "Well, gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that your squadron, the 393rd, has been selected to be the bomb squadron of a new group forming, and you will be the bomb squadron for it." And he said, "My name is Colonel Paul W. Tibbetts, and we'll be working together." And he said, "Right now, I want you to all go on 2 weeks vacation." He said, "Now, you remember, this is a highly secret project. You're not to talk about it. You're not to talk about to anyone about what you do. You're not even to mention Wendover when you leave this base."
Tell him about what he said about the weapon. You didn't tell that part.
I didn't. Well, yeah. I sometimes get crossways. He said this: "You're going to be handling a new secret weapon that's under development still, but when it is developed, we'll be ready to deliver that bomb." He didn't say bomb. He said that weapon. And it's a new secret weapon that, if successful, should shorten the war by at least 2 years. Well, that was good news, you betcha. Well, the 2 week furlough was good news too. What we didn't know is he could care less whether we got rested or not. It was a test to see whether we could keep our mouths shut about being at Wendover. A lot of the guys, when they got home, they had telegrams waiting for them to report back to the base immediately. They were reprimanded and some were shipped out of the unit. He had to be sure that everybody would honor his request for us to, it was an order to keep our mouths shut. How I survived, I'll never know. I don't know. I might have said something to my parents. I don't know. I shouldn't. Anyhow, We went into training immediately, and on December 17th, 1944, the 509th Composite Group was activated. They called it a composite group because there was only one bomb squadron and many other squadrons. And the reason for that is it was such a highly secret project, they could not have any other service groups servicing our unit like you normally would have at a base. You'd have base units would be servicing your group training. So we did go in some very intensive training. Our flight crews were very busy flying missions that we weren't allowed to know where they were. When they get back a couple of days later, we'd say, where you been? They said, can't tell you. So actually, they weren't going that far. They were going over to do some bombing at a bomb range in Southern California. They started using very large bombs because that's what was going to be happening when they would get this unit developed. But I've forgotten, it seems to me they were probably filled with sand, but they use it for the practice balls. And there was a loading pit built at Wendover to load those bombs. The loading pit was just a huge pit with a hydraulic lift in the center. You'd place the bomb on that, lower it down, back the B-29 over that, and hoist the bomb up into the bomb bay. What we didn't know is that they had also built one on Tinian, the island of Tinian. And also, when Iwo Jima was actually taken, they built one on Iwo Jima. And there's a reason for that. So training was complete by late spring of 1945. So we were ready to go. So we started moving to the island of Tinian. I was with the advance echelon. We were to arrive first and start setting things up. The flight crews were to come later. The flight crews, when they were just about ready to fly over to Tinian, they were taken to Omaha, Nebraska, to the factory, where each flight crew picked up a new B-29 with improved engines and all kinds of fancy stuff in them. So they had brand new airplanes to leave Wendover and head to the island of Tinian. This is one of them. This one came out of Omaha. It was just the squadron that all of the B-29s were part of the 393rd Bomb Squadron. But once we got overseas, the 393rd lost its identity because all you ever heard about was 509th. But that was okay. Didn't have anything to say about it anyhow. So anyhow, if you notice the numbering on them, the squadron renumbered each of both planes to benefit the squadron identification of the plane. This is aircraft number 82. So when finally came time to fly some missions, they had finally developed the bomb, and finally, I guess the holdup was developing the detonation system, very different than the normal bombs where the bomb will explode when it hits the ground. These bombs do not explode when they hit the ground. That's not the purpose. They're detonated above ground. When they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, it was set to detonate itself at 1,890 feet above the ground. And it did that. So anyhow, getting back to the plane, aircraft number 82 was selected to carry that first bomb. That was normally flown by Captain Bob Lewis and his crew. So when it was time to fly the mission, our group commander, Colonel Paul W. Tibbetts, decided that he would fly first pilot on that plane for that mission. So he was the airplane commander on that plane. And Captain Bob Lewis had to move over to the other seat and be his assistant. Well, the night they were going to take off, set to go, and just as the plane started moving, Colonel Tibbetts opened that side window and waved. Well, when I saw that picture, I thought, I gotta have my picture taken the same way. So you might see that picture cropping up occasionally. Got on the internet, and I didn't do it. I don't know who put it on there. Anyhow. And that same window is the one that I climbed up in the plane and had to take my picture the same way. That is the plane. Brings back a lot of memories. And it did the mission. It was a brand new airplane at that time. It looks like it is now. Mm-hmm. And beautiful. The second mission. Well, let me back up and tell you about the testing of that first atomic bomb. The one that was dropped in Hiroshima was a uranium bomb. And from then on, they were going to be plutonium bombs. Don't ask me what the difference is. I don't know. wasn't our job to be in the development of it. It was just, we were the delivery boys, okay? So my job was not flight crew, and that picture unfortunately gives the wrong impression. It looks like I might have been a crew member. I was not. That was a photo op, and I'm proud of it. A few days after Hiroshima, one of the other gentlemen in the intelligence office and I went down to the flight line, took each other's picture because of the inspiration we received from seeing the picture of Colonel Poltsevitz. Anyhow, they took off at 2:45 a.m. on August 6th. On August 5th, this airplane, aircraft number 82, was taken to the flight to the loading pit. 9,700-pound bomb was hoisted up into the bomb bay, and it was huge. I saw it, sort of, when they were delivering it over there. It was on a flatbed truck, and I could see it was had a canvas over it, but their canvas just took the shape of the bomb, so it wasn't hiding much. They took off at 2:45 a.m. Everything went well. The reason for that loading pit on Iwo Jima, each one of the missions that were flown, one crew was dispatched to Iwo Jima to be on standby. That so if anything mechanically developed on the airplane between Tinian and Japan, they could land on Iwo Jima and transfer the bomb to the standby plane and complete the mission. That did not happen. The mission went well. When they arrived there, Major Tom Farabee, the bombardier, said, "I see it, I'm on target, give me the control." So he took over with the bomb site and released the bomb. And their instructions was, as soon as that bomb leaves the airplane, do a steep bank and get away from there as fast as you can. And they did that. And Colonel Tibbetts nosed the airplane down a little bit to gain more speed. 45 seconds after that bomb was released from the bomb bay of that airplane, it detonated itself. And in a matter of 1 second, the whole world changed.
Did it ever. It is time for our final break, but there are a couple more things Norris Jernigan said in front of the Enola Gay this past week that are important to hear. And then we're going to hear from two generals, one from the Air Force, one from the Space Force, who were there listening intently to everything you just heard. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, sharing with you a special moment captured this week in Washington, D.C. 100-year-old Norris Jernigan traveled there with Central Valley Honor Flight. The morning after this happened, he would have the privilege, along with three other veterans, to lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. But on an otherwise ordinary Tuesday afternoon, in front of the Enola Gay on display, the last man alive from that plane's squadron shared a little history lesson with an impromptu crowd that included a pair of generals who came out to meet him.
45 seconds after that bomb was released from the bomb bay of that airplane, it detonated itself. And in a matter of 1 second, the whole world changed. I feel it changed for the better. Some would disagree and say it was too fierce a weapon to use on the enemy. I have one word that just says it all: bullshit. You know that? Yeah, that bomb was developed to do a job, and damn it, it did a job. So what's the bellyache? Anyhow, so much for that. 3 days later, no word from the Japanese. We thought maybe the first one would do the job. It did not. So we received our orders to proceed with your second mission. I always get a chuckle out of people saying, you know, the second mission was the Nagasaki mission. It was not the Nagasaki mission. Did you know that? No, it was not the Nagasaki mission. It was the Kokura mission. When they flew the one to Hiroshima, Hiroshima was the initial target. The second alternate was Kokura, and the third alternate was Nagasaki. On the second mission, the initial target was Kokura, and the secondary target was Nagasaki. When they arrived at Kokura, they couldn't even see the city. It was completely clouded over. They made several bomb runs over it, and hoping to find a break in the clouds, they did not. So they decided to proceed to the secondary target, which was Nagasaki. A lot of people think that the Nagasaki mission was flown by boxcar. That's not quite true either. If you look at the nose art on that second plane, we just called it aircraft number 77. If you look at the nose art, it shows a little tuner drill trolley going from Salt Lake City to Nagasaki. When they took off with that bomb, they did not know they were going to Nagasaki. So that artwork was put on there after the mission. The crew of that airplane, Major Fred Bach and his crew, flew that airplane normally. The crew got together and named the airplane Boxcar, B-O-C-K-S. It's stationed at Whiteman Air Force, not Whiteman, no, in Dayton, Ohio.
Wright-Patterson?
Wright-Patterson. Thank you, thank you. I used to have a good memory. Anyhow, it's a beautiful airplane also. And if you're ever in Dayton, Ohio, be sure to take in that museum. You of course, have to enter through the gift shop. Of course you do. And when you leave, you leave through the gift shop. Okay, when you walk out of the gift shop into the first hangar, there's Boxcar sitting right there. And right beside it are two replicas of those two bombs, Little Boy and Fat Man. The replica of Little Boy at Wendover in their museum. And if you ever stop at Wendover, Utah, be sure you visit that museum. There's good history there. And if you look at the replica bomb, stand on the side where the tail fin is to your right. Look right up there, you'll see Norris Jernigan. I was privileged to put my signature on that bomb. So, anyhow, gosh, I'm rambling on and on. You probably want to see a lot of other things too, but I get so enamored when I get on this subject of the Enola Gay. I know the history of it, and I know the history of Boxcar too, and I love to talk about it and reminisce. And when I do speaking engagements, my speeches are not canned speeches. It's just standing there telling you what my memory is telling me at the time. So I hope I've informed you on some things maybe you didn't know before, but anyhow, thank you for being patient and listening to me.
As the applause faded and more people came up for photos, questions, or expressions of gratitude, two generals who had left their Pentagon posts to meet this representation of living history and add to his challenge coin collection took the time to share some of their perspective. Why was it important for you to come out and meet Norris and be here today?
Well, number one, thanks for the opportunity to be here. Brigadier General Matthew Holson, on behalf of the United States Space Force, really an honor for me to meet our nation's heroes. One of the core values in the United States Space Force is connection. And as I have an opportunity to do this, meeting Norris as well as the rest of the veterans, it's connecting our past to our present, to our future, to be able to come here and hear a story firsthand from a living legend that's helped secure our nation's interests and protect us as a nation is just incredibly important and valuable to me, as well as the United States Space Force.
Were there some things that he shared that maybe you hadn't heard before?
Absolutely. So to hear him tell this story firsthand, I think what I loved the most was his first introduction to Colonel Tibbetts and then the story about making sure that they maintained the secrecy of the program. I had not heard that before, obviously as a part of the Manhattan Project and developing just incredible weapons for the United States. But hearing that story firsthand just really makes it real. What our young men and women were asked to do to, in service to our nation, the incredible responsibility, commitment, and duty that they had.
And what's the connection between what they did over 80 years ago and the young men and women that you're leading now?
Really great question. The connection to me is taking a look, you know, as we look in the 1940s, a period of great competition for the nation, young men and women that are pushing technology, in this case, in the air domain, to make sure that we as a nation have the security that we need. And then as I look to today and even into the future, the United States Space Force is our newest service. And looking at building the United States Space Force, the connection on how technology, how determination, how courage and bravery will help face the challenges that we have in the future.
What personally made you want to serve?
So I'm a military brat. My dad served in the United States Air Force. He is my hero. He served for 24 years, retired as a master sergeant. I grew up most of my teenage years around Langley Air Force Base in Hampton, Virginia, listening to the Sound of Freedom, which was the F-15 flying around, looking up and seeing those jets just roar as they went on their training missions. And then obviously looking up to my father who encouraged me to join. That was my motivation for serving. I've always had, as a military brat, that desire to serve our nation, to be able to contribute. I have a degree in electrical engineering, so I wanted to use technology to help our nation from a security standpoint, and then also to follow in my dad's footsteps. I truly believe that we stand on the shoulders of giants, and as I look at my father, as I look at Norris, as I look at the rest of the veterans here on this honor flight, to stand on the shoulder of giants and to push forward to help protect our nation is really what motivated me to serve.
Well, thank you for serving. And maybe last thing, unless there's anything else you want to add, I'm sure you get asked by a lot of people, what exactly is the Space Force? What makes it distinct? I bet you have a pretty good answer for that.
Well, I'll start with kind of the very top line. You know, the United States Space Force is like every other military branch in that we are here to protect our nation's interests. We have learned in sea, on land and in air, that controlling and contesting a domain helps to protect our nation and to provide that safety that we need as a nation. Space is no different. It is a vast domain. It provides advantage for the nation, whether it's through global positioning, having precise positioning, whether it's communications, and other nations recognize that. And I think as we saw when the first Gulf War, the incredible capability that space brings to the joint fight. And so space is incredibly important. It is a new domain, and we as a military service are designed to protect and to further the interests of the nations in space.
Anything else you want to say?
No, just thank you for the incredible opportunity. Thanks for Norris and his service, and thank you for the privilege to be here.
Again, that was Matthew Holston, Brigadier General of the U.S. Space Force, who was joined there by a man who once flew B-2 bombers in the same group, the 509th, that gave Norris Jernigan his connection to the Enola Gay. A command pilot with more than 3,600 flight hours, Lieutenant General Mark Pye is the Deputy Director of Critical Major Weapon Systems at the Pentagon, overseeing resources of more than $250 billion with a B dollars, including Air Force One and the in-development F-47 fighter and B-21 bomber programs.
In many ways, I wish I could do this every day. It is quite the privilege to be able to be with these veterans who gave so much to our country. And I think what Honor Flight brings, having worked with Honor Flight a couple of times, is an ability for all of us to get together and send a couple of messages. To me, the first one is telling them thank you. And while they'll hear for your service for a lot of us, I always tell them thank you for answering your nation's call, which is the same, but is a little bit deeper, because I think that's what we're looking around here. These folks did in a lot of different circumstances as they have a range of different conflicts they served in. And the second message I want them to hear is welcome home. And depending on when and where they served and how that ended as they came back, there are many that did not hear that. So I think it's really important that this organization offers that, both in what it displays and in words and in feeling. You can see it on their faces. This is why I enjoy being part of it.
And you've flown some of the most powerful and expensive planes that our government's put out there, like the B-1 and the B-2. standing next to a much older plane with a guy who's our last connection to it. What was that like? What did that feel like? What did you get out of it?
Oh, man, what a great question. So it was humbling first. It was a privilege to meet Norris, last member of the 509th Composite Group. I haven't had the privilege to do that, to fly bombers in my career. And to answer your question, I guess the most pointed way is we often say that we stand on the shoulders of giants. And I mean that. These are the folks that they've our prior generations, the greatest generation in the case of Norris, they have given us freedom and they have allowed all of us to be able to have opportunities in our lifetime. And so to be able to stand next to someone who's part of that generation, someone who's really is a giant upon whose shoulders which we stand, be able to thank him, say those words, you know, for what he did. And he, as part of the 393 Bomb Squadron and the 509th, both of which I am an alumnus of later, in newer airplanes, in the B-2 specifically, is such a privilege to thank him. Because I think people, what's lost on many is that as they went into that mission, we were staring at estimates of well over 1 million casualties, very likely. There were estimates as high as 1.5 million when you combine the two nations' expected military losses and the number of civilians and the way things had gone in the campaign prior, what the nation had seen. And as you know, you heard Norris mention, this was a way to prevent a lot of that. It certainly was a very difficult decision, but to prevent a lot of that and to really do that for both our nation and, frankly, help end that war and then set up in many ways what has been a prevention of a lot of future wars. And so it's a real privilege to be able to meet someone who did that for all of us and is the last surviving member of that unit, which is pretty special as well. But, yeah, it's fantastic. And to be here with all these other veterans at the same time. I mean, every one of them has a story. Norris's is a very unique and special story, but they all have amazing stories, and they all, again, answered their nation's call when it came in. And for that, we owe them that thanks and that demonstration of our appreciation. So it's humbling to be able to give a little bit of that today.
Well, I know it meant the world to them to see a general with 3 stars on his shoulders talking to them today. Thank you for your service. And my last question would be, what motivates you now? I mean, you've been doing this for a long time, but what drives you? What motivates you?
Yeah, so my wife and I have this conversation. I have passed a few years where I could have hung it up. And so when you join the service, you know, you do it for different reasons. For me, like many in the Air Force, I probably joined for the planes and the mission. What you stay in for is the people. And then as I've become even more senior in my role, what I get up every day thinking about is there were people like me at my level now who thought about how to build the next generation of our air power. So then when Lieutenant Pye showed up and when I got into the service, that I would have what I needed to be able to go, one, hopefully deter war, and two, if called upon as we were, be able to go fight and as many of us could return as possible. Someone did that for me. So what motivates me is an ability and an opportunity to do that for this next generation. They're not going to call my number again. I'm happy to respond, but they're not going to call me again. What they are going to do every day, and which is my privilege, is to go figure out how to deliver the nation's air power that this next generation of lieutenants and captains and young airmen and non-commissioned officers need, so we can give them the tools to keep all of us safe. And if their number is called, as it most likely will one or another, they can do the mission, and as many of them can come home. I wake up every day think about how I'm going to do better for them, that next generation.
From the greatest generation to the latest generation. Thanks again to General Mark Pye and General Matthew Holston. And joining 69 veterans on their honor flight to Washington, D.C. this past week not only gave me the chance to witness those special moments with Norris Jernigan in front of the Enola Gay, but it also reminded me of the power of our veterans to bring the rest of us all together. I watched 5 members of Congress, 2 Democrats and 3 Republicans, put party differences aside in welcoming those vets to the floor of the House of Representatives, the very same chamber where FDR gave his Day of Infamy speech almost 85 years ago. And I saw how the opportunity to honor our World War II veterans has generated over time more appreciation and recognition for the veterans who followed in their footsteps, culminating with a welcome home in front of a capacity airport crowd that hopefully righted some wrongs for veterans who were mistreated when returning decades ago from their service in Vietnam. Honor Flight is all volunteers and supported entirely by donations. So thanks to everyone who has, who is, and who will contribute to make those experiences possible. It sure made for some absolutely priceless moments this week. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.